Well, we talked about, we finished up last time with talking about why you left the commission and your circumstances for that, but we were going to go back a little bit and follow up with a few things. Looks to me like the thing to start with would be the market break of 62.
Okay. By current standards, it was not really much of a market break. I don't quite remember how much the Dow moved and what the percentage amount would be, but it was pretty formidable in its day. I'd like to start with sort of a generalization. Mm-hmm. I was through two market breaks while I was at the SEC. The first one was May 28, 62, and the other was the market break, if you'd call it that, which attended the assassination of President Kennedy in November of 1963. Thereafter, after I left the commission, I was able to observe other market breaks, and particularly the large break in October of 1987, the 87 market break.
That was
when I was at the ICI and thus had still had some connection with the events that took place. My first observation would be is that at times of market crisis, as the numbers parading across the tape reach the national consciousness, the national administration reacts. And they may not think very much about Wall Street, the doings of the market as such, day to day, but when there is a crisis, suddenly people in the White House wake up and they start looking around and for what instrumentalities are available to either get best information or perhaps even to do something about the situation. And so the SEC is discovered periodically by the White House staff in these events, who first thought is that, as these things happen in Washington, we have to do something about this. And so they call the chairman of the SEC. I think that the expectations of the administration as to, A, what the SEC can do about the situation are vastly overblown. And I think an anecdote which I heard from Manny Cohen when he was chairman, there was some market break, not big enough, I think, to hit the historical record, but he received a call from Lyndon Johnson, who proceeded to give Manny a pep talk on how the SEC had to do something about this, and concluded the conversation with Manny, as Manny recounted it to me, "Manny, you are my Mickey Mantle, and I expect nothing less from you than the Yankee fans expect from Mickey Mantle." I think I heard that anecdote within a month or two after the event, and I think Manny was still somewhat in a state of shock. Kind of wished he wasn't in the office that day. Although, as we know, Johnson had a penchant for tracking people down, even when they weren't. To go back to the first market break in May of 1962, if my memory is correct, there were some national events associated with what happened on to the market. There had been some steel price increases, and the administration was concerned, and there was talk of perhaps an antitrust conspiracy on the part of the steel companies, and I think Bobby Kennedy, who was Attorney General at the time, actually sent some FBI agents to roust out of bed a couple of steel executives at night, or at least that's what the story was at the time. And this contributed to a kind of jittery state of affairs on Wall Street, and the market had been conceived to be at a peak sometime before May of 62. I'm gonna unplug this as soon as this call. I wanted to go over to the machine. I'll go one more time. The special study was in full swing by May of 62, and as I've mentioned, I was probably the staff member most closely associated with the issues arising with respect to trading on the New York Stock Exchange, etc. One night, and it may have been the night of May 28th, when the tape ran very late and this market decline took place, I received a call at home about 8 o'clock at night, I'd say, from Chairman Carey. At that point, while I was knew Chairman Carey and the other commissioners, the SEC always being a wonderfully open organization with respect to contact between staff members and commissioners. Nevertheless, I was surprised, flattered, and somewhat upset to get a call from the chairman at home. And in his very, very genuinely deferential approach to people, the chairman first apologized for calling me so late at night, and told me that he had received a call from the White House. He didn't say who. And it was one of these calls, obviously, that I mentioned. What's going on? What can you do about it? What's going to happen? Etc. And, he again didn't mention the caller or the specifics of the conversation. He made it clear those are the kind of questions he was facing. And he said, right off the bat, he realized there was absolutely nothing the SEC could really do about a market break, or B, really only having the ability to collect some limited information, but C, he thought he had to respond to the call, and would I mind going to the exchange that night and being present at the opening on May 29th and get an open telephone line to him so I could report to him. And he made it clear so he could tell the White House that he had somebody, you know, an agent on the scene, as it were. That time there was an overnight sleeper to New York, which I got on and turned up at the exchange around, I think, 8:30 in the morning, and was surprised, although perhaps I shouldn't be, that as far as the exchange was concerned, it was business as usual. As usual, nobody turned up till 9 o'clock. So I was waiting in the street, I recall, to get there until I saw a staff member of the exchange. I recognized him. He brought me inside and brought me up to the executive offices, where I met with Keith Hunston as he arrived. Nobody told me this, but I inferred from what happened next that the exchange officials rapidly formed the belief that I had in my briefcase an order closing the stock exchange, which the commission has the power to do on the signature of the president. I could see a certain fixation developing with respect to my briefcase. That's when I sort of formed the belief that that's what they thought I was there for. And indeed, they insisted that I sequester myself in the office that's ordinarily used when he's around, of the chairman of the exchange, which was right next to Keith Funston's office, because they didn't want anybody to see me, because this would give rise to the story that I was there to take drastic action. I think this, you know, may have been, again, part of the us versus them kind of mentality that set in between the Kennedy administration and certain segments of the financial community. Of course, nothing was further from anyone's thought that that's what we would do, at least in Washington. And my suspicions were somewhat fortified because within a half hour, the very distinguished outside counsel for the New York Stock Exchange, Sam Rosenberry, from Milbank Tweed or Lord Day and Lord, I don't remember which firm, it was Milbank Tweed, turned up to, quote, keep me company. I was then informed that everyone really believed that the market would straighten out and there would not be any terrible repetition of tape being hours late. And indeed, based on form, historical form, after a day like May 28th, it would not have been that unusual at all for there to be some recovery on May 29th, as indeed there was.
Did you come up with an explanation as to why the break the day before?
No. We didn't engage in any study of causation. What we did study thereafter, and it appears in the special study report, behavior of members on the floor, the specialists, members trading on the exchange, etc. And there was no indication of any conspiratorial action to knock prices down or to cause any kind of panic. And as the specialists, we found what we had found thereafter, that the picture was a mixed picture. some specialists did exactly what they were supposed to do, try to moderate the action of the market. Some, but not many, seemed to accentuate the trend, market trend downward by dumping their positions early and often. So there was no conclusion about the system based on the market break, except in a sense a potentially positive thought that if a number of specialists were able to perform the function of maintaining a fair and orderly market insofar as circumstances permitted, then appropriate regulation could potentially encourage such behavior, as against a situation where you found that no specialist would be acting in a positive fashion, which would lead one to suspect that the system itself was a total failure, and that it was economically impossible for specialists to function in a positive manner.
One of the questions of the special study was whether the specialists should be allowed to continue like this as a function in the exchange. So it sounds like this is one of the arguments.
Yeah, as I say, one which pointed to at least to a positive conclusion about the system. And as I mentioned last time, under normal circumstances, stocks are much more thinly traded than people have historically believed, with all the volume being spread over a long trading day. And that the routine humdrum activity of the specialists did serve to prevent large price discontinuities during the course of a day. So much for the May 62 market break. I don't remember if I was made to wear a face mask when I left the exchange. And I suppose we can fast forward to more tragic events of November 63. Actually, two things happened at once. One, the national calamity of the president's assassination. The other, a more parochial calamity involving the New York Stock Exchange and the brokerage community itself. And that was the infamous situation involving a man called Tino De Angelis and the so-called salad oil scandal, which brought down the firm of Ira Haupt and Company, which at that time was about the sixth largest brokerage firm, I believe. We first got word, taking this sequentially, a week before September, November 22nd, that there was some trouble involving soybean oil futures on the street, and the press centered in on Ira Haupt and company as being in potential difficulties. Again, we were still in the special study, And but I think by that time it was recognized that the personnel of the special study had the most current expertise, call it that, about the street. So, in a sense, we were pressed into an operational mode rather than a study mode. Just through the special study, however, I had met senior lawyer, I forget which firm, who represented Ira Haupt. And Ralph Saul and I were talking about these rumors, and I suggested, and with his concurrence, I called the lawyer for Ira Haupt to take a sounding as to what was happening. And he confirmed that there was a problem involving warehouse certificates, futures trading, and soybean oil futures, and that the situation was still very uncertain. There were several potential problems as a result of this. At that time, there was no SIPC. There was no Securities Investors Protection Corporation, if that's its name. There was not even the predecessor to SIPC, which actually was created by the Ira Haupt failure, and that was a fund maintained by the New York Stock Exchange to bail out customers of a failed firm. Indeed, the only precedent for exchange, New York Stock Exchange action, was a very limited one which had occurred in the late 50s when a small New York Stock Exchange firm called DuPont Hamsi had failed, and the commission itself, not the staff of the commission, pressured the New York Stock Exchange to come to the relief of the retail customers of DuPont Hamsi. I should have mentioned, just for the record, although I think that people that look at these archives will be acquainted with this, is that the problem here arises from the fact that retail customers of brokers will have on deposit huge balances of cash and securities which they own, which are left for safekeeping or for margin purposes with stock exchange firms. If a stock exchange firm or any broker-dealer fails, there is at least the possibility that customers having nothing to do with the failure, their funds and securities will be in some jeopardy, at the least tied up for periods of time in bankruptcy proceedings, and at worst would actually be in jeopardy of losing significant assets. The rules of the commission and the New York Stock Exchange did require, through various formulas, capital maintenance requirements applying to stock exchange firms limiting the amount of debt that they could undertake and requiring capital to be generally in liquid form and unencumbered. However, these formulas, while providing protection in the ordinary course of business, would not necessarily stand up when either fraud was involved or some other dramatic failure of a brokerage firm. Under the commission rules then, and probably still today, the commission has its own capital rules applying to broker-dealers. However, there is an exemption for members of stock exchanges whose rules are more strict than the SEC's rule. However, there had always been the situation existed that if a member firm of such an exchange violated the exchange's capital rule, it would then fall under the commission's capital rule, giving the commission some handle with respect to that situation. In any event, the situation during the week preceding November 22nd with respect to Ira Howe became more and more serious, and I went to New York on the night of November 21st and met with tried to meet with some people in the New York Regional Office of the SEC who didn't seem to have a complete picture of what was going on. We agreed to meet again before the opening of business on the morning of November 22nd, and we did, and made an appointment while I was at the SEC to see the vice president in charge of member firms at the New York Stock Exchange, and we went over. With me was somebody from the regional office, and again one of the people from the special study who we had resident in New York City, Dick Meyer. We got to the exchange, again probably before the opening of business, and did meet with Bob Bishop, who was, as I say, vice president of member firms, and found that, again, the exchange had very little information. They had inspectors at Ira Haupt, but that they had come up with no conclusion as yet as to what was really happening. I had previously put in a call to the lawyer for Ira Haupt, telling him I was going to be there, and that we would probably be at the office of Ira Haupt around 9 o'clock in the morning. And we went from the exchange to the offices of Ira Haupt, and were greeted with a sight that must have been, to anyone who had lived through it, reminiscent of what happened in 1929. By this time, the financial columns were pretty full with the Ira Haupt story, and there was a line of customers stretching down the street, hundreds of feet, waiting for Ira Haupt to open so they could get in and get their funds and securities out of the firm. We sort of fought our way into the lobby, and at that time a gentleman approached us who said that he was from the CEA, the Commodity Exchange Administration, which was the predecessor of the CFTC, and that he sort of inferred from the what we were doing that we were agents of another government agency, and told us that he had absolutely failed in the attempts to get into the firm, and could he join our group? So we did. And we got over to the receptionist desk, found things very confused. We asked to wait. We waited about 10 minutes, and finally I made one of these threatening messages to be delivered that if they didn't see us in the next 15 minutes, we'd see them in district court. And what made this urgent is I could observe down the corridor there was the cage. In those days it really was the cage. And that was the place where funds and securities were delivered in and out of brokerage firms on a routine basis during the course of the day. Except that we discovered that this was no longer routine, that there were four bankers from Ira Haupt's creditor banks, four vice presidents of major New York City banks who were creditors of Ira Haupt, standing inside the cage and divvying up money and securities as it was delivered in to Ira Haupt. This, of course, was disturbing to us, because again, from our point of view, we conceived our mission to be protection of customers' funds and securities. So, finally, we were ushered up to the sixth floor, or wherever it was, to the senior partner's office, and we found out the reason for the chaotic reception we received, and that is, until that morning, the firm was under the belief that the trading operation of De Angelis, which was designed to corner the soybean oil market, had left them nearly bankrupt, but still solvent. Although they were in violation of the capital rules, that nevertheless they believed that they were still solvent to about $500,000. That was predicated on the belief that the warehouse receipts that they had, the oil farms that you could see across the river in New Jersey, were filled with soybean oil in the tanks. Somebody had gone over the night before with dipsticks, and it was discovered those tanks were empty or contained water. This meant that the warehouse receipts were worthless, and the firm was in fact insolvent to the amount of $30 million. The interruptions were constant. People were coming in and out, and finally the partner in charge put somebody at the door and said, "Don't let anybody else in." About 5 minutes later, somebody did walk in, and that was the secretary of the firm's chairman, and she had the first tear sheet off the Dow Jones ticker that the president had been shot in Dallas, whereupon the scene dissolved into complete chaos. And all I could think of doing was to say that we would adjourn the meeting, but reconvene tomorrow morning, Saturday morning at 9 o'clock. So again, while I recognized that the national situation took precedence, there was still the question of the customers of the firm. I was up and back to Washington twice that weekend, and of course concentrating from my point of view not on the national problem but on the Ira Haupt and the exchange problem. Our thinking was really in sync with that of Keith Funston, the exchange's president, that the exchange should not reopen ex the national scene, but not reopen until the Ira Haupt problem was solved and the customers of Ira Haupt were made whole. There's tremendous opposition from Wall Street having to make contributions. The usual refrain was, I didn't cause the problem, why should I have to bail out these crooks, etc., etc., etc. And
so the contribution, this whole plan to make good, was something orchestrated by the exchange?
Well, it was developed in conversations with the exchange. And I think the exchange was thinking that already. The commission had the DuPont-Humsey precedent, and so that's what the commission wanted. And so that's what we pressed on the exchange, but found the thinking in sync. This time, my trip to the exchange was... I was not sequestered. Keith Funston asked me, this was on Monday morning, asked me to sit outside his office while he had in the senior partners of exchange members. And obviously it was my function to be the bad guy sitting outside. And I'm sure that Funston, I'm certain that Funston used my presence there to twist the arms that either they put in the money or that was the alternative, and that was left unspoken as to what would happen. And so the matter was put to bed that day. That gave rise, as I say, to the fund created by the New York Stock Exchange for such purposes, which in itself came a cropper when the back office collapse some years later proved too demanding on the exchange fund, and SIPC was created by legislation. These are nice anecdotes, but the point that I'd like to leave is that there is this misunderstanding of what the commission can really do in situations of market crisis. Actually, in the Ira Haupt affair, there was, as it turned out, something the commission could do through jawboning and implied threats to at least ameliorate that part of the situation on the street. Certainly nothing the commission could do to ameliorate the fallout that was going to occur from the president's assassination. Ironically, on the afternoon, going back to that Friday afternoon after the assassination, I suppose I was the senior staff member from the division in New York, and I tried to call both Ralph Saul and the chairman, found all the government tie lines at that time, the system completely clogged and jammed, and commercial telephone lines were all clogged and jammed to Washington. So there was no way I could contact the commission, and no way, as I discovered later, they were trying to contact me. The reason being that on both sides, for I wanted to make contact, is to make sure the exchange did the sensible thing and would close right away after the president was assassinated, because for obvious reasons. But the exchange did that on their own in any event, so anything the commission might do was moot at that point. And indeed, somewhat ironic, because the commission's authority to close the exchanges, as I said, required the signature of the president. It wasn't contemplated that the president would be assassinated. The last thing Johnson would be doing in Texas would be signing orders with respect to the stock exchange. But again, the basic point is that there's really not much the commission can do above symbolic activity at the most, when market forces are creating pandemonium on the street. I think Harvey Pitt, for example, did the most the commission could do, and did it very well. At 9/11, when he appeared at the opening of the New York Stock Exchange to express confidence in the fact that the market was going to be able to function properly. After this was all over, Chairman Carey asked if I would write a memorandum on what steps the commission might take in a market break. And I made a few technical suggestions, such as suspending stop loss orders, such as try to slow down activity on the exchange. But at the end, I put in sort of a point six, whatever it was, and said about the only thing that would be really effective would be create a false ticker tape showing the market going up. That was tongue-in-cheek, and I recognized as such. Maybe that memorandum still resides in the chairman's safe.
Yeah, you never know. Well, we talked a little bit last time about the interim period when you left the SEC, and even working with Bernie Kornfeld for a while. I want to talk about your becoming involved with the investment company and your experience.
Okay, I spent a very exciting year representing the American subsidiary of iOS. But found myself being involved in the SEC investigation of iOS, which was simply uncomfortable for me, even though represented no direct conflict with the SEC. And so I determined to leave at the end of the first year. And I did. In deciding what to do next, I spoke to a number of people, and was recalled to me that the SEC was probably moving in the direction at that time of further regulation of the mutual fund industry, and that the Trade Association, the Investment Company Institute, then located in New York, was really not geared to handle regulatory matters. It was suggested that I might talk to the president of the ICI, Bob Augenblick, and I did, and that led to my joining the staff as associate general counsel. Bob was general counsel and president. He was actually general counsel at that point. The president, a gentleman by the name of Dorsey Richardson, was retiring, and the understanding was that Bob was going to become president upon his retirement 7 or 8 months later, which in fact occurred. For a year or two, Bob retained the title of general counsel. I was associate general counsel and then became general counsel.
Were you aware of the ICI in earlier years during the time of special study in the institute? Did you know about the institute?
I knew it existed. And
did it have a reputation or anything?
Not much of a reputation one way or the other. I was once in Chairman Cohn's office when a delegation from the ICI visited him, a kind of courtesy call, and Manny asked me to stay. So it was really just a courtesy call lasting about 10 or 15 minutes. And after they left, Manny said something like, well, I won't see these fellows again until next year. So the contact between the ICI and the commission was less than routine.
It was pretty pro forma.
Yeah. So right from the beginning, I was hired with the understanding that my role would be to establish a more direct contact with the commission and follow the regulatory or legislative activity that was going to result from the studies that the commission was performing, which basically was a follow-on to the Wharton School report of 1957, as I mentioned last time, was somewhat fueled by this residual fear in Washington that, again, coming out of the great crash, that if the mutual funds ever unwound for any reason, it would lead to calamities in the marketplace as funds dumped their securities on the market to meet redemptions, etc. What became clear after a while is that Manny Cohn had decided to make this reform of the mutual fund regulation a centerpiece of his regime. I have always personally felt that new chairman of the SEC, if anybody coming into a new significant job, look for their own projects and don't put as first priority the projects being pursued by his predecessors. So Bill Carey, having sort of occupied the field with the special study and its implementation, the white whale left for Manny was the mutual fund industry, and he set about with great energy, vigor, and his supreme intelligence to formulate and enact legislation.
Was there any kind of groundswell or public sentiment that this needed to be done? That the mutual fund industry needed a study? I mean, the special study certainly had important incidents that generated.
Yeah. All those headlines I showed you last week.
So how about the mutual
fund? No. And that probably was a inhibiting factor as far as the ability of the Commission to achieve easily its legislative goals. We could spend a couple of days on the details of the legislative combat that took place between 1966, when the Commission published its report analyzing and extending the old Wharton School study under the title of Public Policy Implications of Investment Company Growth. The primary author of that was Dick Phillips, and Mike Eisenberg worked with him on it.
Was this combat between you and the FEC? And where was the combat?
Well, it was a legislative combat that lasted for 4 years. Ended up, I think, in reasonable compromises. The problem on the industry side was, as one does get in every industry, I suppose, those who want to fight government regulation to the death. Others who take a more statesmanlike view. I think I have to sort of make a general comment about the nature of trade associations generally and the ICI in particular. You naturally contain members whose economic interests and business interests are not overlapped tremendously, but are not necessarily wholly congruent with each other. So that forgetting about differences of philosophy, temperament, personality, proposed government regulation or legislation will impact the organizations within an industry somewhat differently, so that there is a potential division among the membership of an industry simply based upon the economic aspects of the of their own situations. And the more detailed or in a sense, even narrow government regulation is, it will particularly impact upon specific organizations and may leave others relatively untouched.
More
pinpoint. Well, no, if you're making black widgets and the proposed regulation says you can't make black widgets,
yeah.
People that make gray widgets and brown widgets are say, you know, let's make a deal.
Okay,
it's too bad, Charlie.
They're all for the
okay.
I
also, then you really do have to get into next the questions of philosophy and personality, etc. And within the securities industry, and the mutual fund industry is one part of the securities industry, especially when we go back, as I said earlier, to the 60s, with the memory of the 30s and 20s not still relatively fresh, the center of gravity within the securities industry recognized government regulation as a positive and not as a negative. The degree of regulation was to be quarrelsome, and the burden argument was always around, and bureaucratic interference has always been a problem. But nevertheless, when all is said and done, I think that the securities industry has had a more positive view of government regulation than we might say ordinary industrial organizations and throughout the economy.
Let me take just a minute and say this